From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aarons.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Today, we're broadcasting live from the University of Pennsylvania Carey Law School with a room full of law students, the next generation of legal scholars and attorneys. Welcome, welcome, welcome to the program, friends.
Oh, lovely, lovely, lovely. The 250th anniversary of our country's founding is fast approaching with big celebrations coming this summer, especially here in Philadelphia, the birthplace of American democracy, the Declaration of Independence, and the Constitution, so eat your heart out, Boston. As we approach that milestone, we thought there was no better moment to ask a fundamental question. How has the Supreme Court shaped, reflected, and sometimes constrained the democratic experiment that began right here?
As many of you likely know, the court hasn't always been a pro-democratic institution. There are plenty of famous or infamous decisions that check the country's progress toward the freedoms and rights that we hold so dearly. Today, we're going to dig into the push and pull between a court that protects the ideals of a multiracial democracy and one that undermines it. And we'll use three landmark cases from Reconstruction to modern day to help us understand that tension.
And we have two terrific Penn legal scholars with us to help us understand the history. Why don't I introduce them? Kermit Roosevelt is the David Berger Professor of Administrative Justice at the University of Pennsylvania Carey Law School and author of The Nation That Never Was, Reconstructing America's Story. Kermit, thanks for being with us on Studio 2.
Thanks so much for having me. Happy to be here.
We also have Amanda Shaner, an associate professor and Walpole family faculty scholar at the Wharton School. Before coming to Penn, she was a practicing civil rights lawyer at the ACLU. Amanda, so nice to see you.
You too. So excited to be here with y'all.
Yay. And so we kind of want to just lay the foundation because we tend to take Article 3 of the U.S. Constitution for granted and the whole existence of the Supreme Court and the judicial branch. But Kermit, I want you to take us back to the founding, and I want to look at what the debate actually looked like. Were the framers comfortable with creating a judicial body that could effectively overrule the decisions of elected lawmakers?
Well, you know, when we're trying to understand who we are as a nation at 250, we do need, I think, to look back to the founding, and we need to understand really how different we are from the founders. Because one of the things we like to do as Americans is say, you know, we're a nation, we're committed to certain values, and they come to us from 1776. But in 1776, we're not a nation at all. We're really a collection of independent states. And we're not committed to any values in particular. We're committed to the idea, really, that the states can go their own way. And the Articles of Confederation, the first American attempt at self-governance, really embody that lesson. We've got no national government, basically. But that doesn't work. We decide we need a stronger national government. Now we're going to have a Congress that can make laws. And we need federal judges to ensure that federal law means the same thing in every state and that the states are going to respect federal law. So the need for the Supreme Court comes about initially because you can't leave these questions up to state judges. So they're really thinking about sort of federal judges versus state judges. The concern about federal judges overruling the policy choices of legislatures is really something that comes along later, in part because the federal government at the beginning isn't supposed to be doing very much, and the Constitution that's written in 1787 doesn't place a lot of limits on what the states can do. So the national government is kind of hands-off as far as individual rights are concerned, and federal judges are going to be kind of hands-off too.
And why not embed this judiciary in the executive branch, legislative branch? Why does it have to be its own thing, Kermit? Like, what's the idea behind that?
Well, the idea there is this basic idea that the founders have of separation of powers, which is if you let one person or one branch of government have too much power, then they can abuse that. Now, maybe you don't worry about that so much with Congress. To get a bad, tyrannical Congress, you have to have a lot of people acting together. But in the executive branch, which is headed by one person, you could have one bad president who starts behaving tyrannically.
No.
And it could happen. You know, just don't get complacent.
Okay.
It could happen. And then you're in trouble, right? So they want another branch of government. They want independent people who are going to say, this is what the law is, and you can't cross that line.
Yeah, is the idea to create this court, these bodies of courts, that sort of safeguard the Constitution, or was it sort of just federal law generally?
The Constitution is also sort of the special concern of the Supreme Court. Now, the president takes an oath to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution. So I really believe that every branch of government should think about their constitutional responsibilities. Yeah. We've sort of gotten away from that idea, I'm afraid. But the Supreme Court is going to have the last word on the meaning of the Constitution. So, you know, the president probably shouldn't sign a bill unless he thinks it's constitutional. Congress shouldn't vote for it. But it's the Supreme Court that's going to have the last word in that process. They're going to give the final sort of thumbs up or thumbs down.
They're the backstop. Amanda, bringing you into the conversation, at one point, because Kermit says sort of like in the those founding moments, it's not entirely clear what power this new branch of government has. Where do you see the Supreme Court assert itself as having real authority over the states?
Over the states?
Yeah.
So it's really not until Reconstruction, I think, that you see the big shift from the federal government being smaller and sort of like all of the rights that we now think about as being sort of like the foundation of American constitutionalism. Those aren't really the product of the founding. They're the product of Reconstruction. That's, in fact, where we get all of our rights against the states. And all of the things that we sort of like think of as important, including First Amendment rights against the states, including religious rights against the states. And it's not until that period, much, much later, until after the Civil War, that we get the idea even of multiracial democracy and inclusive democracy that now we think of as so key to the American constitutional project.
Yeah, and I think I realize while, you know, I look at Article 3 because you think, oh, the Article 3 courts, you just take so much for granted. But I realize when it gave instructions, when the founders gave instructions for Article 3 courts and the creation of the Supreme Court, it prescribed its, you know, jurisdiction, but it was really silent other than that on what the court would necessarily be, other than, you know, it would look at the Constitution and be the arbiter of that. But it wasn't like, you know, you're supposed to be the protector of individual rights. And, you know, and so I think in our minds, maybe, we have this idea of the court being like this superpower to protect mm-hmm. individuals. Amanda, I see your face sort of light up a little bit and when you hear that, because we have this very idealized view of the court, but you made the argument that that is not necessarily true, initially anyway.
Certainly not initially. And that idea of courts actually that you just sort of conveyed, and I think that many law students feel, I think many Americans feel, is actually really a much later product of the civil rights era, right? And the Warren Court, and the period of time in which we see, for example, the 14th Amendment being expanded to include protections against sex discrimination, which originally the 14th Amendment didn't include. And so it's actually that period that gives us this vision of a court as an individual rights protector.
Great foreshadowing,
yes.
Amanda. So we teased this at the top of the show. We're going to talk about three pivotal cases. The first one is one that I know all of you in the audience know about, and probably a lot of the folks listening at home or in the car know about. It's Plessy versus Ferguson in the 1890s. So it's very fitting we're going to begin this legal odyssey with a man named Homer Plessy. So tell us, Amanda, about Plessy versus Ferguson, the facts of the case.
So Plessy versus Ferguson involved actually a setup case by a train company and a multiracial civil rights group from New Orleans. And what they did was they decided together to challenge a law in Louisiana that required that public accommodations, and here train cars, be segregated by race. And so what they did is Homer Plessy sat on the white car, even though under Louisiana law he was considered a black man. And he was then kicked off of the train, and he challenged the law. And this goes to the Supreme Court after the Civil War, after the adoption of the 14th Amendment. Okay, so after the Civil War, we get the adoption of three really important, in many ways, some of the most important of the constitutional amendments. That's the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. And the 14th Amendment protects states from violating equal protection. And so the question is, can Louisiana have a law does it violate equal protection to have a law that says you have to have segregated train cars? And the Supreme Court says, no, that's completely fine. They say that's not a problem of equal protection because separate but equal is sufficient for constitutional purposes.
So they're working out what this idea of equal means, Kermit. I mean, it seems maybe self-evident today, maybe not, I don't know, but that sort of what equal would imply. But around the time of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, what are people saying about this idea of equal protection and what it implies in the law?
Well, so to understand the context of Plessy, I think you have to look a little bit more at the history around Reconstruction. Because if you're just looking at the date, you'll be like, oh, you know, 1890s, they're pretty close to the ratification of the 14th Amendment. They must understand what it means. But what you have to understand there is that that might have been true in, you know, the 1870s or even into the 1880s, but Reconstruction didn't last very long. So after the Compromise of 1877, federal troops stand down from the role that they've been playing protecting these racially integrated Reconstruction governments that the Reconstruction Congress has built up in the southern states. And then there's basically a wave of military coups that pass over the South, and white Democrats take back power. And they try basically to reinstate the pre-Civil War system. So the racially integrated Louisiana legislature during Reconstruction bans segregation. They prohibit segregation on railroad cars. The all-white Democrat government that takes back power after Reconstruction, during the period historians call Redemption, they require segregation. And people have very different conceptions of what equality means there, basically because they have different beliefs about how the world is. So you can look at what the court says about equality over time, and it tends to reflect the views of the people who are in power. So if you've got the racially integrated Republican government in power, they're going to say equality is about sort of the fundamental dignity of all people, and everyone is supposed to be equal. Society shouldn't have classes. We shouldn't be racially stratified. The Redeemers, the white supremacists who take back power, have a very different view, and their view is the world is by nature racially stratified, and we're just sort of reflecting the way things are, and, you know, what else do you expect us to do? This is not an attempt to impose inequality. It's just a neutral reflection of the way the world is. And you get, you know, eight justices signing on to that. So looking back now, it's hard for us to understand how anyone could say this is not stigmatizing, this is not an attempt to create a racially stratified society. But elite legal opinion at the time kind of supported that. Or at least they said we need to trust the state legislature on this.
It's not us to say.
Yeah. And I wonder, I want people to be, you know, clear in case people did not understand what was happening during this time, because a lot of folks did not learn in school, Kermit, that, you know, there were many advances that happened with black people once they became recognized as citizens and got the right to vote and all those things. They were very represented in the legislature once they got that right to vote. And so could you just explain what sort of Reconstruction really allowed people do and to do, black people to do, and then sort of the impact that Plessy had on that? And I think you touched on that, but I want to be explicit there.
Yeah, so there's a period of time when the promise of a multiracial democracy is a reality in the former Confederate states. And black people are allowed to vote, and black people hold office, and they integrate their police forces. They integrate schools in some places. They provide public services at a level that the South has never seen before. They step up public schooling. They reform divorce laws. They actually move in the direction of sex equality. So there is this big progressive movement that's transforming Southern society, but of course it's transforming it in a way that the former Confederates don't like and aren't willing to accept. And the whole thing really relies on the presence of the U.S. Army. Because in the background, all the time, there's this undercurrent of violence. It periodically explodes into massacres. And the federal troops are required to keep order. Because basically, you've got the former Confederate Army fighting now against the racially integrated police forces and state militias. And the Reconstruction governments don't actually have the military power to stand up on their own. So when the federal troops withdraw, you get a wave of violence, you get suppression of voting, and then you get the whole thing sort of locked into place through laws like the one in Plessy v. Ferguson.
But there is a dissent. And we're going to talk about it on the other side of this break. We'll also get into two more key cases that really tell us about how the Supreme Court developed. We're talking with Kermit Roosevelt and Amanda Shaner. You are listening to Studio 2 on WHYY. Don't go anywhere.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine is helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer.
All right. Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron. We are broadcasting live this hour from the University of Pennsylvania Carey Law School, where we are joined by a room full of lovely law students. Woo-hoo. We're exploring the history of the Supreme Court and its role in American democracy just ahead of the 250th anniversary of our nation.
And it's a history defined by a central tension between a court that pushed for broader, more expansive interpretations of our constitutional rights and one that at times pulled back from those democratic ideals.
To help us make sense of that history and its impact, we have two University of Pennsylvania scholars with us. Kermit Roosevelt is a professor at the Carey Law School and author of The Nation That Never Was, Reconstructing America's Story. Amanda Shaner is an associate professor at the Wharton School, formerly an ACLU civil rights attorney. And we were talking before the break about Plessy versus Ferguson, and there's this lone dissent by John Marshall Harlan. And boy, interesting dissent to read. Mm-hmm. Then the kids would say there's some bangers in here.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of interesting stuff.
He
predicts it's going to be like the next Dred Scott. Mm-hmm. But good prediction, Kermit? Bad prediction?
Well, that prediction was spot on. So, you know, you can survey constitutional law professors. What are the Supreme Court's worst decisions? Dred Scott, probably number one. But Plessy is probably number two.
Yeah. He also has an interesting quote here in the dissent where he says, "Further, if this statute of Louisiana is consistent with the personal liberty of citizens, why may not the state require the separation in railroad coaches of native and naturalized citizens of the U.S. or of Protestants and Roman Catholics?" The idea that separation is a slippery slope, Amanda, where does that come from? And then how does that contrast with the reality of how it played out?
So I think that Harlan understood in a fundamental way, because he was from the South, what separation was as a matter of social, political, cultural reality. He knew it was about subjugation. And then in fact, so the majority says essentially, like, if black people think this is, you know, to make them feel inferior, that's their construction of it. And Harlan knew anything that it was anything but the case, and that in fact separation was to create a stratified community at society after the end of slavery. And in fact, he was right that what happened following Plessy was the institution of Jim Crow laws, of black codes, of redlining, all the forms of oppression that we think of as being endemic in the South. Those things were not foregone conclusions before Plessy.
I guess what I'm thinking of here as a layperson trying to revisit this case that I kind of, you know, took for granted, is this idea of whether you can read social context into a law at the time it was passed or even after it was passed. Is that what we're dancing around here, Kermit? Is that fundamentally one of the questions we're trying to answer here?
Yeah, that is. And that actually gets at one of the really deep and persistent questions about the role of the Supreme Court, I think, and whether courts should be involved in value choices or policy choices. Because if you ask Americans, do you want the Supreme Court to defend constitutional rights even when it's not popular? People say, yes, of course, absolutely, right? My rights aren't up to a vote. But if you ask Americans, do you want the Supreme Court to impose its values on the nation in the guise of constitutional interpretation? Americans will say no, right? That's the bad judge. So we have these two visions, yeah. The good judge who defends constitutional rights and the bad judge who imposes their policy views on the nation. And it's very hard to figure out what's going on in yeah. some of these controversial cases, because the people who like the decision will say the court's doing the right thing, they're defending constitutional rights. The people who don't like them will say, no, this is judicial imposition of values.
I want to, because Harlan looked at the same constitution and saw a colorblind democracy and the constitution that his colleagues looked at and saw room for segregation. And so were they applying a different theory of constitutional interpretation here? Because we hear these, you know, I'm a strict constructionist, all these different points of view of how to construe, how to analyze, how to apply the Constitution. Or were they, in this case, reflecting the social and political realities of their time? And so was there some kind of political construction viewpoint that allowed this, or was it something else, Amanda?
So, I mean, I think there's a lot of background here that we need to understand, which is even this idea of inclusive democracy is not one that we get from the founding, right? We think about we the people, but the founders weren't really enthused about the type of democracy that we have today, or that we think of as being like absolutely foundational to the American constitutional project. And they adopted a bunch of different institutional kind of aspects to insulate democracy by way of sort of aristocratic devices. Mm. And so there's a long history of not the thing that we now think of as being central. And the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment were brought to us by people who had a much more capacious understanding of democracy that was informing what equality was. And the court that interpreted that was there during that time period, but weren't on board with that project. And so what they saw, and I think what they wanted, was the Constitution more as it was before, mm-hmm. rather than the Constitution that was adopted sort of in the aftermath of the Civil War period.
And so, Kermit, I'd love to get your thoughts. Is it sort of that court reinterpreting what was, to me, for a lot of folks, a fairly clear understanding of these new amendments that came out of Reconstruction? Or, because I'm trying to figure out, like, what legal interpretation led this to being, allowed the court to adopt this separate but equal rule? And I'm trying to understand it as we look at how the court sort of changes the way it interprets the Constitution, like these legal methods of interpreting the Constitution.
Well, at the time, I don't think that people were as focused on interpretive methodology, at least not explicitly, as they are now. But I do think that what you're seeing in Plessy is sort of what Amanda was saying, which is the court is trying to go back to the founding, in a sense. So, you know, you've got the Civil War, you've got this incredible rupture in American history, you've got the Reconstruction Amendments that fundamentally transform the Constitution, and you've got all of these individual rights that people can assert against the states that they couldn't. You've got all these constitutional limits on what states can and can't do. And so you might expect that the court would go out there and start enforcing those rights and make this transformation of American society real. But in Plessy v. Ferguson and some of the other cases from around then, they explicitly say, we're not going to do that. We're not going to interpret this amendment to fundamentally change the relationship between the states, the people, and the national government. And the only thing you can say in the court's defense, I think, is that that was what America was doing on the whole. So the executive branch tells the troops to stand down. Congress doesn't enact bills to enforce these Reconstruction amendments. And the Supreme Court by itself could not transform Southern society. You know, you see something like this happening later in the civil rights era, but that's when the court is working with Congress and the president. So this is a retreat yeah. from Reconstruction.
Amanda, you wanted to add itself. Something there?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, Congress in this time period and the president, Lincoln at least, you know, until Lincoln was shot, we had a government that was deeply committed to broader forms of democracy and to forms of racial justice that the country had never seen before. And they passed civil rights laws that look a whole lot like the same civil rights laws that were passed in the 1960s. But the Supreme Court struck them down. And they struck down a whole bunch of other things that the political branches were doing and had the will to do. and that then we weren't as a nation able to do until approximately 100 years later.
Yeah.
And so I think that they did a lot to stop the movement for multiracial democracy.
I think what you're saying is that at the front end and the tail end, the Supreme Court is helping the retreat, is what you're saying. So it's not just that they're following what the other branches.
Okay. Aggressively.
So let's move forward now to our second case, which takes place in 1938, U.S. versus Caroline Products. I've never been a professor. I'll probably never be a professor. It's my one chance to do this, okay? So we're going to show
it
of
out,
hands,
lay it
okay?
Out.
Show of hands. In the year 1938, how many people think the U.S. Supreme Court had its own building where it met? So it didn't meet inside the congressional building. Who says, yes, it had its own building by 1938? Only one, two, three people. And who says, no, they did not have their own building in 1938?
A lot of people
most of the people. Yeah. All the yeses had it. It was, but only barely. The U.S. Supreme Court building, yeah, go whoop it up. The one guy who got it. So we're talking about the evolution of the power and the prestige of the court, right? It's not until 1935, I believe, that the U.S. Supreme Court actually meets in its own facility. So it's just starting to establish in the physical world some of its muscle, right? And so let's get to this case, U.S. versus Caroline Products. So Kermit, could you walk us through this case? It has to do with alternative forms of milk, which I find very funny because that's all the rage right now. It feels so modern. But U.S. versus Caroline Products, what is actually at issue in this case?
Well, so Caroline Products is a funny case, and it's a case that is really famous among lawyers but not so famous outside the legal community. And its significance really has very little to do with filled milk or, you know, what's going on in the top level of the opinion. But just quickly, what's going on there is that Congress had banned filled milk. So Congress banned milk from which the fat has been skimmed away and it's been replaced by some other source of fat. In this case, it was coconut oil.
Delicious.
So Milnut. No, that's what I tell my students.
Does this product
breakfast.
Still exist today? Does anyone know whether
it
this
actually does?
It does.
So Congress banned it. They were like, this is terrible. This is unhealthy. And the Supreme Court, this is one of the things Caroline Products is known for, the Supreme Court said, sure, if you think it's unhealthy, you can ban it. We're not going to second guess you on that. But, you know, food science is always changing. So actually, Milnut comes back. Caroline Products has been reversed. Like the idea that this is bad for you, a district court said, no, actually, it's good. And now you can buy it in fine establishments anywhere.
Yeah. But the thing about this case that, and I mean, this is when you learn, I guess you all have learned this in law school, read the footnotes. because this case is actually not famous for the facts of the case, but actually for footnote number 4. And so, Amanda, could you tell us about footnote number 4 and why it had, it opened the door to what we know now as being a new Supreme Court and a defender of individual rights. Explain that.
So before Caroline Products footnote 4, and actually just before the year before 1937, we had a period of time from the late 1800s, again until 1937, in which the Supreme Court sort of like principally thought of itself as the protector of individual economic liberty and as the bulwark against overweening governments who wanted to pass things like minimum wage laws that were violating people's individual rights to contract for whatever they wanted. And there were lots of governments that were trying to respond to the Industrial Revolution and then later the Great Depression, and the court was stopping them.
Yeah.
And then in 1937, the court essentially, like Justice Roberts, switches sides, okay, in what we call the switch in time that saved nine, meaning nine members of the Supreme Court. And we get the New Deal, and we get the court saying, actually, we're not going to stop you from passing economic regulations in the name of the Constitution. We're going to allow the democratic branches to do, essentially to defer to them to decide what to do.
And real quick, I think you alluded to the reason they might have done this, which is that Roosevelt, is talking about potentially packing the court. And so they're saying, maybe we'll give a little ground here.
We'll capitulate.
And you'll back off, too.
Yeah, that's the lore, at least.
Yes.
There's now more modern historical work that suggests that, you know, they, too, saw the Great Depression and were already kind of moving away from it. But yes.
Yes.
And so then the question is, then what's the role of the court? Like, what are they doing anymore? And footnote 4 is the court's effort to build what its new vision is going to be. And the idea is it's going to protect the sort of fidelity of the democratic system. And so it's going to lean in and scrutinize laws that where there's a problem with the democratic process. But otherwise, if democracy is working as it should, it's going to defer.
And the court sort of creates this special scrutiny, strict scrutiny. This is the first time we hear about this, where it says that, you know, it will you know, provide the rational basis unless, you know, a political process targets discrete or insular minorities. First of all, I want to ask you, why do you think they put it in a footnote, you know, versus just in the text of the actual decision? And then, you know, just the reaction to the creation of this new level of scrutiny.
So it's in a footnote because the case is not about those things.
Yeah,
the case
is
about, you know, coconut milk or whatever, right?
But it's like, it just so changed. It just...
Yeah, but they're flagging, okay, but this is, you know, this is the way we're going to treat what they call, you know, ordinary economic and social legislation. Mm-hmm. But there may be other times they say footnote where something else, where there's a different role that's necessary for the courts.
Just in case this comes up in the future, we might have something to say about X, Y, and Z. It's so mealy-mouthed when you actually read it. It's amazing how powerful it truly is.
Yeah.
You know, Amanda brought up this idea, Kermit, of like, well, if the court is retreating from this one role it's had in terms of laws like the milk law, that it needs to have some vision for what it actually does here. What exactly do you do here, Supreme Court? Do you think that's like part of the motivation here, or is it also just, look, social winds are changing, the ideologies of the judges are changing, justices are changing? Is it a mixture of both? Because in some ways it feels a little bit like self-preservation, like, well, we're not going to do this. We got to do something here. Is it more complicated than that, or is that part of it?
Oh, I think that's part of it. So I think the Supreme Court was facing basically the problem that, you know, as I said before, Americans have these two visions of judges. There's the good judges who defend constitutional rights and the bad judges who impose their own values. And the court was trying to set out conditions under which it could actually step in and invalidate the democratically elected legislature's policy choice and still say we're being the good judges. So the question is, when is it okay for the court to engage in aggressive judicial review or invalidation of legislative acts? And basically what they came up with was, one, you know, if it's sort of clear from the text of the Constitution, that's the first part of the footnote. Two, if the legislature is interfering with the democratic process. So we defer to the legislature usually because they reflect the will of the people. And most of the time, the people should get their way.
But something like voting. Something like voting,
yeah. But if the legislature is messing with the democratic process, then that justification for deference goes away. And then the third part, the discrete and insular minorities subject to prejudice, that's also about a situation where we don't think the democratic process is going to work. The legislature is not going to weigh everyone's interests fairly and accurately. So that's about equality.
Yeah.
And so that gets us right to what afterwards? Real quick, we're coming up on a break, Amanda, but what are the big cases that follow from this?
The big cases that follow from this idea are cases like Brown v. Board of Education, mm-hmm. right? That overrule Plessy and say, in fact, things like segregation are unconstitutional.
Yeah. So we're about to take a break, and we're going to talk on the other side about a case that y'all might remember because you were alive for it. Well, maybe, I don't know. They were alive. Maybe not in law school yet. But we're going to talk about a case decided within the last 15 years that represents a new direction.
The Roberts Court.
The
yes.
court. So you're listening to Studio 2 on WHYY. We are talking with Amanda Shaner and Kermit Roosevelt about the making of the modern Supreme Court. This is 90.9, your local NPR member station. Don't go anywhere.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine is helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer.
And welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. We're at the University of Pennsylvania Carey Law School, where we've been tracing the history of the U.S. Supreme Court and talking about how different generations of justices have interpreted the Constitution and its democratic ideals.
We've almost reached the current Supreme Court. We're about to get into the Roberts Court, but we want to do a little bit more history before we get there. Let me reintroduce our guest, Kermit Roosevelt, professor at the University of Pennsylvania Carey Law School and author of The Nation That Never Was, Reconstructing America's Story, and Amanda Shaner, associate professor at the Wharton School. Before coming to Penn, she was a practicing civil rights lawyer at the ACLU.
And so right before the break, we teased another case that we're going to get to in just a moment. But, you know, people took footnote 4 in Caroline Products, and really it became the basis of what we know as modern civil rights law that affected not just, you know, the racial caste, but gender, all different things. Can you sort of summarize all that came out of that before we saw the more recent rollback of rights? And Amanda, I'll start with you, and if you want to add anything, Kermit, just jump right in.
Sure. Well, I say a background fact about our Constitution that's really important to understand this trajectory is that our Constitution is really short and broadly worded. You know, it's like 4 pages in that big, you know, scrolly handwriting, and it has words like equality in it, right, where you can interpret that in lots of different ways. And that means that how every generation, not just of justices, but of Americans, think about these questions can radically influence how the courts, too, understand what the Constitution to mean and require. And so what you see during sort of like the mid-century period following footnote 4 is you see the court, especially the Warren Court, understand equality in a very broad way, including not just racial equality, but also things like questioning whether, you know, the 14th Amendment, which was passed in a time period where women didn't even have separate legal personhood under the law, okay, whether or not equality required or permitted the court to say there is constitutional prohibitions against sex discrimination. And the court says yes. So essentially what happens is the court thinks even more broadly than just, you know, racial minorities, discrete and insular minorities, that's thinking about it, footnote 4, to increase the types of people, the types of groups, and the meaning of what equality requires far more broadly than that, too.
Yeah. And one of the crown jewels of the civil rights movement was the Voting Rights Act.
Yeah.
And the next case we're going to talk about is Shelby County versus Holder, a 2013 Supreme Court decision that struck down a large part, a most critical part of this act. That happened then. And so, Kermit, if you could tell us the facts of that case and why it's so significant.
So the mid-century civil rights movement, it's often called the Second Reconstruction. And I think that's a really useful way to think about what's going on in America, because we had the First Reconstruction, where, you know, we make this promise of equality with the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. We make a promise of democracy with the 15th Amendment, which forbids racial discrimination in voting. And then, as we've been saying, you know, all of that gets rolled back, and racial segregation kind of undoes the equality of the 14th Amendment. And racial discrimination in voting really undoes the promise of the 15th Amendment. So black voting rights are basically nullified throughout the South. And it's not until the Voting Rights Act of 1965 comes in and gives you federal enforcement of voting rights that actually you get a meaningful restoration of multiracial democracy. And one of the most important things that the Voting Rights Act of 1965 did was it said to some states, if you want to change your voting laws, you must get approval from the Department of Justice before you do that. This is called the preclearance provision. And the reason that that's important is that you can have, you know, a constitutional ban on racial discrimination in voting, and maybe people can enforce that if they're not allowed to vote. Or, you know, you can have a Voting Rights Act that says states don't violate the 15th Amendment, and maybe the Department of Justice can enforce that. But it's very hard to do that in an effective way if you're just relying on individual suits after the states change their laws, because you're kind of playing whack-a-mole with changes that the states do. You know, one gets struck down, another one pops up, and you're trying to do all of this with changes that they enact right before elections, or, you know, discriminatory practices that they put into place at particular polling places, and it's just not practically effective. So the preclearance provision stops states from doing bad things to evade judicial review and federal supervision, and this is really what makes it meaningful and effective.
But then, in Shelby County versus Holder, there's a challenge to this preclearance provision. And it's a strange case to read about, I guess, because there's lots of clauses underneath these big laws. This has to do with something called Section 4B. But my understanding of it is they're just looking at the formula by which they determine which jurisdictions qualify for preclearance. And what the U.S. Supreme Court does in 2013 is say, this formula is kind of no good anymore. It's out of date. First of all, am I right about that? But then also, why would that be such a big deal? Just make a new formula, it seems like. So why is that so important, Amanda?
Why is that so important?
Yep.
Because it bears on whether or not states will be able to enact types of measures that will restrict who can vote, or how they vote, or those sorts of things, and whether or not they'll actually have to go bring those measures first to the Department of Justice. And if they have to do that preclearance process, they're much less likely to bring stuff that probably would, you know, violate the law. And so it means a real change, a sea change in how voting is done in the United States.
Yeah, and what does this signal about the court, Kermit? The fact that they've tossed this?
Well, so they did say that the formula was out of date, but the main thing that they did was they disregarded all of the findings that Congress had made. So Congress reauthorized the Voting Rights Act, they reauthorized the preclearance provision, they did this unanimously, and they held hearings where people testified about discriminatory practices, and the court looked at the record that Congress had assembled and said, that's not good enough, we know better than you. So this is a really aggressive court, it's disrespectful of Congress, and maybe most importantly, it's seeing Congress not as its partner anymore, but more as its adversary. Mm-hmm. So during the civil rights era, Congress and the court are working together. Congress is passing civil rights acts. The court is upholding them against constitutional challenges. The court is deciding Brown. The court is deciding Loving. But now, Congress is still out there trying to enforce the 15th Amendment and protect voting rights, and suddenly the court is its enemy. Suddenly the court is saying, that's not good enough for us.
Yeah, and I think about when we just talked about Plessy, and we talked about how, you know, we had all these new amendments to the U.S. Constitution. We had, you know, a Congress that really wanted to instill rights and give more individual rights. And you think about the second Reconstruction and with the Civil Rights Movement, and now we look past Shelby County, and recent Supreme Court decisions suggest a continued retreat from the protections. And so, can you help us draw the line between what we saw and this retreat, you know, in granting and upholding individual rights that we saw, you know, in Plessy? We saw that retreat, and can you draw the line to what we've seen since Shelby County, Amanda?
So I really think the Supreme Court has fundamentally changed how it thinks about its role, right? It's to go back to the Caroline footnote 4, I think it doesn't think about itself in the same way as being a protector of democracy. Mm. And and so what that means is it's not just Shelby County, but it's, you know, approval of gerrymandering, and it's money in politics, and it's a retreat also from enforcing broadly civil rights laws. And so there's a whole... It's of a piece with a larger shift in how the court thinks about itself. And I'll say some of that has to do with certain ideas about methodologically how we should interpret the Constitution, things like originalism. So originalism, actually, the founders weren't originalists, just In fact, originalism wasn't something that was developed as an idea until the 1980s, principally by the Reagan administration, but now is something that we think of as being, you know, core to how the Supreme Court thinks about the Constitution. And I think it's some of those things that have shifted us away, indeed deliberately shifted us away from the court conceiving of itself as the protector of multiracial democracy.
And so what is the court then telling us from this decision onward? They're saying, look, if you didn't write it down in the Constitution, if you didn't spell it out, we don't want anything to do with it? Is it more nuanced than that? I mean, what is the court, Kermit, telling us with this series of decisions about what it thinks the Constitution says?
Well, I think the court is really telling us that it likes the founding better than Reconstruction. Like, that's one way of putting it. Another way of putting it is we're in the second redemption. So, you know, you've got Reconstruction. It lasts maybe 8 years. You've got multiracial democracies. Redemption sweeps that away. You got the second Reconstruction with the Civil Rights Movement. It lasts a little bit longer. You could say maybe 53 to 69. Like, that's basically the Warren Court. But then the second redemption, I think, comes in, and you really see it with the election of Ronald Reagan and some of Reagan's rhetoric. So he's talking about states' rights. He's talking about federal judges interfering with state policy choices. And originalism, like Amanda said, really rises to prominence through the Reagan administration Justice Department. And what's interesting about them, I think, is they're complaining about a lot of Warren Court, Supreme Court decisions. Almost all of those are 14th Amendment decisions.
Right.
So if you're really an originalist, you want to know the original understanding, the rational thing to say there would be, okay, we're going to really study 1868. We want to know more about Reconstruction and how people understood the 14th Amendment. But all of their rhetoric is about the founding instead. They're like, we want to go back to 1787 or 1791. We're going to take you back to before Reconstruction.
So we acknowledge 13th, 14th, 15th, you're in there. But if it's not very, very specific, we're kind of going to look past it and go further back in time. Is that about right?
Yeah, so they are kind of doing what the Plessy Court was, which is trying to restore the founding balance. And, you know, you can see this. They love to cite the Federalist Papers. The Federalist Papers are written about the pre-Civil War Constitution. Yeah. If you're trying to figure out the balance between the federal government and the states, and you're looking at the Federalist Papers, you'll find Federalist 46, where James Madison is saying, don't worry, the states will defeat the national government in a war. You know, this is not our world anymore.
So we're going to open it up for a couple of questions from students. Let's first hear from Victoria Shea, class of 2028, a student originally from Bellevue, Washington. Victoria, you've been listening to the conversation. What question do you have for our panelists?
Yeah, thank you so much for being here. We've talked a lot about equality and the court's interpretation of equality and how they're on a retreat and shifting more towards the original values of the founding. To what extent has that affected their current interpretation of equality, and what does that implicate for our nation's future?
Amanda, you want to take that?
So it's meant a whole lot of things. I mean, I think you all are aware of the sort of raft of different opinions that we have, including, for example, the Dobbs opinion rolling back Roe v. Wade. But I think it's broader than that, and it's not even just originalist in a certain sense. It's not just changes in understanding of equality, but also they've been leaning more towards accepting a much broader understanding of executive power in ways that I think are radically important in our current moment. But I guess I'll say the way that we got all of these ideas, the way that we got Reconstruction was a robust movement for multiracial democracy and abolitionists and formerly enslaved people. And the way that we got, you know, the civil rights laws was because we had the civil rights movement. And the way that we got a lot of what we have now was the Reagan Revolution. But that also means that it's you all and your ideas that will define how we think about equality in the next generation. And to me, that's a really exciting and hopeful thing. But it means it's really much more in your hands rather than just in the Supreme Court's hands. And I think that's the most important thing that we have to remember.
And we're going to try to squeeze in one more question. We have Gustavo Abonsa, also class of 2028 from Miami. What's your question, Gustavo?
Yeah, thank you for being here. So my question is, in the Shelby County case, the court was going against Congress, but we talked about the court kind of wanting to defer when the other branches are trying to push an agenda. Why do the court feel empowered to do so in that case?
Kermit, you want to take that one?
Well, you know, I think that's a difficult question. If I were trying to defend the court, I'm not exactly sure what I would say. Because I do think one of the problems with this court is it doesn't do a very good job of explaining when it's deferential and when it's not. And, you know, that's sort of what Caroline Products was about. When can we trust the legislature? Here are the reasons we think sometimes we can't. Now, in Shelby County, what are the reasons that you can't trust Congress to protect voting rights? There's certainly no Caroline Products rationale there. What the court seems to be doing now more and more is actually refusing to respect legislative attempts to promote equality or to protect minorities. So this is a court that, rather than protecting the discrete and insular minorities subject to prejudice, rather than protecting the weak, it's really more protecting the powerful.
And I have to also point out, Gustavo is one of the few people that got my very stupid trivia question right. So thank you for that, Gustavo and Victoria. And thank you all for being here today,
yes,
at the University of Pennsylvania Carey Law School. Give yourselves a round of applause. And let us also thank our amazing guest today, Kermit Roosevelt, professor at the University of Pennsylvania Carey Law School and author of The Nation That Never Was, Reconstructing America's Story. Kermit, thank you so much for your time today on Studio 2. And an equal thanks to Amanda Shaner, associate professor at the Wharton School. Before coming to Penn, she was a practicing civil rights attorney at the ACLU. Amanda, so lovely to have you today on Studio 2.
Yes, and of course, we couldn't do any of what we do without our producers, Debbie Builder, who's been directing us today. Thank you so much. Also, Hazel May Bryan and Paige Murray Bessler. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer. Al Banks, Adam Staniszewski, and Tina Kalike engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCory from the University of Pennsylvania Carey Law School in Philadelphia. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman. Aaron, thank you so much for joining us. Studio 2, we'll be back tomorrow at noon right here on WHYY.